But you were saying about it on now, the background of the family. Who are the O'Malleys, really?
Well, first of all, you must call it O'Malley. They're very fussy about that. But most of the Irish people who spell their name that way call it O'Malley. Mm-hmm. I think these particular ones, who come from County Mayo, the extreme west of Ireland, called near Westport, call it O'Malley. And her grandfather, it's quite important, this family background, because she was a person to whom family meant a great deal. Her grandfather, Patrick O'Malley, left Ireland to read the English bar. He was a lawyer. Because he had another brother who was also reading the bar, and they didn't feel there was room for them, that both at the Dublin bar. And he was the one who decided to come to London. And he married a Miss Rodwell, that's a Suffolk family, they come from Holbrook near Ipswich. And those were her father's, Ida's father's parents. Her mother's parents were young husbands, which is also a very ancient, quite distinguished family. I mean, Sir Francis Young.
The explorers, you mean?
Yes, he was a cousin, distant cousin. So her mother was called, she was Mary Frances' young husband, and the young husbands were mostly a service family. They had a very strong service background. Ida's grandfather was a head of Woolwich one day. They were gunners, and her father was a gunner. He was in the Royal Horse Artillery. And so she grew up in this sort of background, first of all, of two rather ancient families who quite sort of fancied themselves on being, they were very keen on families. Although they actually, the thing I've never been able to quite discover is how her grandfather, at what point that branch of the O'Malley ceased to be Roman Catholics, because they weren't an Anglo-Irish, they weren't a Norman family, they were really an old Irish family, O'Malley is just a transliteration of a Gaelic.
But
at some point or other, quite far back, they had become, they'd ceased to be Catholics. I think this had happened before he came over. Certainly when he married Miss Rodwell, she was a very evangelical, very religious, sort of strict evangelical Anglican. And they had five children, of which my grandfather was the second son, Tyler's father, George Hunter O'Malley. And he, the eldest son, followed his father and became a lawyer. He ended up as a colonial judge, and the second son went into the army. And that was where he met his future wife, because he was also a gunner, and he met some. Because he was a regular soldier, Ida's youth, a good deal of her childhood was spent moving about, and she, in fact, I think she was born in London, in South Hampstead, near to where she afterwards settled to live. But quite early on, when she was, I think, about four, her father's battery went out to Halifax, Nova Scotia. And so she spent a little of her extreme, and that was a time when she very nearly died of diphtheria, but she was preserved. Then he came back, and was again at home for a bit. And then, I think about 1886, she was born in 1873, he was moved to Gibraltar. And they were in Gibraltar for about 4 or 5 years. And she first started going to school in Gibraltar. Gibraltar, of course, was almost entirely English in those days. It was completely inhabited by, it was like India. English society there. Now, when her father was moved back, I think they then were at Shorncliffe, but I'm not quite sure. But for a short time, she went up to be in Newcastle with relations of her mother's side called Jones, and they're quite important because they were a large family of daughters with whom she was very, very friendly. sisters. Because she had no sister, she had just the younger brother who was my father.
Oh, I see, yes.
And there was a good gap between them, almost about 9 years between them. So she spent some time in near Newcastle, the Joneses, and again, I suppose, went to school there. And then, when she was about 15, I think, they decided to send her to a girls' public school, and she was sent to St. Leonard's School, St. Andrews.
That school comes up time and time again in the women's movement.
Yes, yes. Well, it was. It was a sort of...
very important school.
Very important school, isn't it? Yes. And there she must have met some of the people. I'm not quite sure whether Barbara Hammond was at St. Leonard's, but certainly some of the people whom she afterwards knew at Oxford.
Yes, Lady Rhonda was one of the people.
That's right. Yes, she was. Well, she had this a girl who had spent a good deal in going abroad, very much with parents and grandparents especially. She was very devoted to her maternal grandfather and grandmother, and indeed when her maternal grandmother, Mary, and the young husband died, which was, I think, in shortly after they came back from Gibraltar, I think, sometime after that, then the father-in-law, the grandfather, the young husband, general young husband, lived with them. Now I think my grandfather must have had rather a tough time, because in fact, his wife, you see, was terribly fixated on her father, and this sort of parent-child relationship was very dominant in this family. And then Ida was very devoted to them too, and they all absolutely adored her, and she was quite spoiled, I think. But they were also very well educated, because her mother, who was a difficult character, I think I never actually met her, she died long before my parents married, but from what I've heard from sort of relations and people, she was a rather a frustrated person. In a way, she was very intellectual. She was frightfully interested, she and her father were very interested in Darwin and Osman Huxley at arms. And she sort of weaned George away from his evangelical kind of churchy background. So they were all complete agnostics, that sort of household. And she was keen on, very keen on women being properly educated. She wrote quite a bit herself, but she only published one book, a novel called A Very Woman, which I'm afraid I haven't got. So I don't know who published it. One of my other sons took it because he was so tickled by it.
I'm sure I could find that in Bodley, actually.
It's under her. Mary Frances Emily, it is published under her own name. It's a three-volume novel, which is absolutely unusual to me, at least. Yes. Called A Very Woman. Yes, but anyway, and there was a great deal of going abroad, you see, and like people very often, Mary Frances was rather an invalid. I think she was a nervous invalid, you know. She suffered a great deal from neuralgia. And she was really what would now be called a neurasthenic, I think. And she was given morphine, which became a problem, actually, from time to time. You know, she used to allow people to get morphine for her.
Sort of addicted in a way.
She was a bit addicted, I think, really, yes. And this affected my father rather adversely afterwards, I think. He was unhealthy and also difficult, and had a very difficult childhood. But, I had a very interesting girlhood, you see, in a way. She was being brought, or they went out of Florence for the winter, or they went to Spezia, they went to Artenberg. They would spend whole winters to get away from the English climate, either with her mother and grandfather, usually them, because her father was usually occupied somewhere else. You know, of course, if he was stationed somewhere nice, they were with him. And then, until she got to this St. Leonard's, I should think her education was very sort of, her education was culturally very, very wide, but possibly a bit sort of spasmodic.
I understand, yes.
On the other hand, she was quite Oh, she was good at language. She was very, very good at French. She was always a fluent French speaker, and she read French with real enjoyment. I mean, you know, she never dreamt of reading a French book in a translation. She was really amused.
Was that, Jerry, so many things to take for granted in that generation at that social level?
Yes.
But
yes.
Now, I mean, even academic people have to.
Yes, yes. Well, then, after leaving St. Leonard's, she went to Lady Margaret Hall. And there she met up with Barbara Bradbury, who became Barbara Hammond. She made great friends with a certain Evelyn Gunter, who afterwards, who I think introduced her to Maud Royne, because I don't think Maud Royne was at LMH with her. I don't think she was at LMH. I'm not quite sure where she was.
I think she was at LMH, actually, but certainly it was.
Well, then she must have been before, I think. Mm-hmm. She must have, she was older. Another person called Maud Allen, who's,
yes, you've heard
of her, yes. Well, I've got a photograph. Would you like to see that now or to a later stage?
I'd like to see it now, if I may. Croom Brown.
Mary Croom Brown, yes. No, she was more or less adopted, not quite, not officially adopted, but she was looked after by Ida's parents, because her father was, it was one of the cases of a fellow officer who was killed or something.
Yes, yes.
And so Mary Croom Brown lived with them a lot, and they did things a lot together. And I think she often became a headmistress, but and then that's Evelyn Gunter.
Oh, yes, yes.
And she's, now that was just somebody called Winnie Adkins, who became a Mrs. Lovegrove. I don't know anything about her. I don't think she went in for.
Yes, and you've got all the names at the back here, yes, I see. Evelyn Gunter was a friend and companion of Maud Royden, I see.
Yes, afterwards they lived together, most of Maud Royden's, the time when she wasn't living with the
Hudson Shaw.
Hudson Shaw, yes.
So really, how important was all this in your aunt's life, would you say?
Well,
these connections,
I think,
and so on.
I think very important. I think it sort of gave her a... And I think the other thing that was very important was the people she met through this family, the Joneses. Because I think she probably met... In fact, she may have got involved in suffrage through them, because Mrs. Mary Jones, who was her aunt, was one of her son, she had two sons, and one son who was killed in the war married a Garrett.
Oh.
Marjorie Garrett, who later on, after he died, she married in Spring Rise, Marjorie Spring Rise. Mm. And it seems to me that it's possible, because I couldn't really trace how she got on to except with Maud Royne, but then you see she wasn't really mixed up with suffrage people at that stage, I don't think. I think she was more mixed up. I mean, she was running this place of Dearmer.
Yes, yes.
I'm not quite clear about all this. She was certainly very, very fond of her. When after her mother died and her grandfather died, she left Oxford in 1900. She and her father went to live in Oxford, and they lived in 102 Banbury Road, which is how it still stands. And
one of those big detached Victorian houses.
Yes, it's nearly the corner of Linton Road. Now, at that stage, she certainly was very, very close with Maud Royden, because there are one or two photographs of tours abroad in which Maud is with her and her father. You know, they went to Florence together, and there's another holiday in Cornwall. And another person whom she also met up with them, who doesn't appear in the Oxford photographs, Kathleen Courtney.
Oh, yes. Mm. I met her just before she died.
Yes. Well, she was a great friend too. But I think that she couldn't have done very much apart from being very interested in women's rights while her father was still alive, because she certainly was more or was devoted to him. But in 1909, I think, he died. And in 1809, I've got dates written down somewhere, but I was with him. Anyway, round about then. And she then went to London, and I think that was when she really took up suffrage. And she may have taken it up through the Joneses, or I don't really know how she met. But it did occur to me that she could easily have met Mrs. Fawcett through the Garrett connection. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a possibility. Mm-hmm.
Of course, Courtney and Maud Royden. Maud Royden was very much involved in suffrage at that time.
Was she at that time? Yes. Oh, well, then that was probably the thing that in the end that really pushed her into it. During the time at Oxford, during the years at Oxford, my aunt was converted to Christianity by, I think, Curly Fathers, actually, and was confirmed at the age of 33, which must have required a certain amount of determination. And then became a pretty high church devout, and she went to St. Albans Hope, and, you know, she liked it hot and strong. I mean, she really was another very strong influence in her life was Charlotte Yonge, because she absolutely adored Charlotte Yonge's books. And we were all brought up, I mean, Ray was too, and we all had Charlotte Yonge in our backpacks. And
how could Charlotte Yonge influence her in the sense that Charlotte Yonge is anti-suffrage and all that?
I know, that was very odd. I know, it was most peculiar, but nevertheless, I think her sort of historical, I mean, her first sort of leanings towards being really interested in history came from reading the Charlotte Yonge's historical novels, which happened to a good many people at that age. You know,
oh, yes.
She did popularise history in a rather romanticised sort of way.
Yes.
But she certainly had an enormous collection of Charlotte Yonge's and read them all, Great Joanna, and only really just had to make the, you know, allowances for her anti-feminism and so on.
What about Meredith?
Yes, well, she was keen on Meredith too. I remember her reading aloud Meredith to me when I was 12. Yes, I better go on now just to the stage where I come into the picture, because see, after she'd been living in Chelsea, in this house in Chelsea, and doing suffrage, in 1910, my father married, when she'd just gone there, and my father married a Miss Carroll, who was an Irish girl living in South America. He went out to the Argentine. He sold up from there. I mean, he was also a regular gunner, but he sold up to that point and went out to South America to make his fortune. My father was a very very erratic character, and absolutely hopeless about money. And he met this beautiful Miss Carroll, of the highly romantic courtship took place on board ship. I mean, I got some really touching letters about it. And brought her back, and they married. And they went, and he got a job as a motor salesman, and they went to live in Radlett, in Hertfordshire, just north of London. And there I was born. And very shortly afterwards, much too shortly afterwards, 15 months afterwards, my sister was born. And 10 days after birth, my sister, my mother died of an embolism. Absolutely, completely out of the blue. No one expected it. It was the most terrific shock to everybody. And at that point, there are several letters from her friends. There's a letter from Mrs. Fawcett and a letter from Pippa. Pippa merely just says how awful for you. You know, and it's very sympathetic. Mrs. Fawcett says, we're all wondering whether this is going to affect your suffrage work. Well, it didn't straight away very much. It did, I suppose, to a certain extent, in the fact that after about 6 months, just immediately after my mother's death, the nurse and I and the monthly nurse and the baby were all taken to one of my mother's brothers and his wife, who had a family and were living in Kensington. But this didn't last very long, because then she offered to share her house in Hempstead Island with her brother and Britain to have the children.
To really make a household.
Yes. So we went there. And that was, must have been in, well, either late 1913 or early 1914. And my earliest recollections, I don't remember the house and rent at all, I was too little, I don't remember my mother, but my earliest recollections are living there with a nanny and my baby sister and auntie and daddy had been in and out, you know. We were there for several years then, but in 1916, I think, or maybe, I think it was probably early 1916, he had gone back into the army, because of course he had been called up at the beginning of the war as a reservist. He remarried, and he married a country girl from March, totally different background, really working class background. How he got to know, I don't know, she'd become a secretary, she'd had rather a romantic sort of rise, somebody's secretary in London anyway, he met her, fell in love, remarried, and so we were taken away from my aunt.
Sounds rather disruptive, the whole thing.
It was very disruptive. At that point, she threw herself straight back into suffrage, you see, vigorously. So, and I don't think she'd really left off during the time we were in the house, because I mean, we were very little. We couldn't have, apart from the fact that, you know, she had us in the house. We always had a nurse, and there were always maids and so on. And I don't suppose she really did very much about us, except let us be there.
You would combine being a mother figure and
yes,
public work in those days.
Yes, at that point you could, yes. And so we then went off with my stepmother and sort of in a way moved out of her life, and she threw herself. And that was the time, I think, between